Hello, I'm Christy Lucas, CEO of Roots for Boots, signing on as your guest host here at Community Media for another edition of Open House. And I have with me today one dynamic duo, two superstars, colonels, right, in the military, husband and wife team, over 60 years of service between the two of you. So let's see, I know Carolyn, you have 37 or more years of service, and Martin, 26 years?
That is correct.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for your service. So what we're going to do today is get to know you all a little bit better, get to know your story, and then the purpose is to try to get ways to make the upcoming Memorial Day holiday a little bit more memorable. So we want to get your thoughts on that, your perspective from a military perspective, okay? So, and you've been married 42 years?
Yes.
Carolyn's nodding yes, so you had a little bit of hesitation there. So we're going to begin with Carolyn. And I love your story because I think I read it in an article somewhere where you started as a private on a dairy farm, and then now you are a colonel in the United States Army. So, and you enlisted in 1975, and you did everything from flight operations to military intelligence, and one of your big accomplishments was you were the first female distinguished honor graduate in the history of the New Jersey Army National Guard OCS Academy. Yes. So talk about that a little bit. What's that all about? And what does OCS stand for?
Officer Candidate School.
Okay.
So I enlisted in the Army in 1975 in a delayed entry program when I graduated from high school.
Okay.
And then I went to the Officer Candidate School in New Jersey in 1984.
It's a lot of years of service.
Yes, and got commissioned in 1985.
Okay.
So during so I had 10 years of enlisted experience and then went through the Officer Candidate School, and I kind of felt like I was cheating because I already had enlisted experience, and so I knew what it was all about. A lot of the other candidates were like 18 years old and didn't, really know what they were getting into. But I did my best and ended up being the honor graduate.
What did it feel like to be the first?
It's just what I don't know. It was just happened. I mean, I had no idea that was going to happen because there's the academic. Obviously, you can track how your academic standing is. But then for the outstanding award, it takes into leadership and academics and several other aspects.
Okay. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank
That's quite
you.
An accomplishment. Why did you join the military?
I wanted to get off the farm.
That's simple?
Yes. So I grew up on a Pennsylvania Dutch dairy farm just south of Allentown. And I was the last of seven kids. So my mom, with typical dairy farm wife, she had six kids in 9 years. Wow. And I came along 9 years later. So I grew up in a totally different environment, really, than my siblings, and I loved to travel, and I wanted to be an airline stewardess when I got out of high school, but I couldn't because I was only 18. You needed to be 21 to serve drinks and to be mature enough. So I ended up thinking, okay, well, I was looking at a 17 magazine one day, and in the middle of 17 magazine was a foldout of, be all you can be, but it was that was the idea. Today's Army wants to join you, I believe, because it was right.
So the slogan caught your eye?
The pictures of castles in Germany.
Oh.
So I was like, oh, I'd like to do that. And so I tore out a little card, yes, and mailed it in. I had no idea what I was doing. But I was like, oh, I'd like to have more information on this. And, of course, then the recruiter called me, And I had a very good one, and he listened to me say I wanted to be in aviation, or, you know, but I only wanted to do 3 years. And so he helped me find flight operations as a career field. And then I did that, and then I kept going, and then all of a sudden it was 37 plus years later when I was retiring.
Yeah. So what are some highlights of your service? Can you, have you got any highlights?
Well, I must say that I believe one of the proudest days of my life was the day I graduated from basic training, because I had no idea that I would be capable of doing the things that I did, whether it was physical training. I qualified as a expert in rifle training, and so that was a great accomplishment. And then, of course, when I got commissioned in 85 and got my commission, and then just traveling around and working with the other soldiers and officers in the military. I mean, it's a family.
Yes. And, and you like to travel.
Yes, yes.
So, trying to keep up everything on your bio that you sent me. It's like, oh my gosh, she has been all over the place.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So as a woman in the military with 37 years experience, I imagine you've seen a lot of change.
Yes.
Yeah, so can you talk to that a little bit?
So when I came into the military, it was the last 2 years of the Women's Army Corps, and that was before, women were actually part of the official military, active component military. There were obviously a lot of nurses that had been serving and had been in Vietnam prior, and other, you know, World War One and Two and lots of other places that women had served. But coming into the military, I did not realize at the time the significance of that, of being at the end of the Women's Army Corps. In reading subsequent books, I learned that at the time, women were not allowed to be in command of men. And I never knew that at the time. It was all new to me anyway. And there was a long time when women were not allowed to be married. And even when I went in and was serving, if you got pregnant, you had to leave. You could not be in the military. And to see women were not always entitled to monetary support to because they had dependents. You know, now if everybody who serves, if you have dependents, family, that you can are given what do they call
it? Stipend.
Yeah, stipend, or you know, you're given.
Like there's a benefit there.
Yes, yeah, it's a benefit. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. That's a lot in itself.
Yeah. So that was the things that caught me now, and then the other really great accomplishments in the last years is that, you know, all of the military specialties are open to women. We have, you know, Rangers, we have women that have gone and done some amazing things. Not every woman that joins the military wants to do that, but at least it's a choice.
Not all men want to do it either.
That's a good point.
Yes.
So is there anything else you want to tell about your story before we switch to Martin?
I had a wonderful career. I had a wonderful family that was always very supportive. It wasn't easy. There were a lot of ups and downs. I used to say, especially in my, you know, later years when I was in command and different things, and I'd go from one assignment to the other, it was sort of like, it's the same roller coaster. It's just a different park, you know, up and down. And it was difficult when we had to, you know, call up units to deploy, especially the reserves and the National Guard. And that's what the last 10 years of my career, I was in the active Guard Reserve program. So we were tasked to provide troops. So, yes.
All right, Martin, you spent most of your time in the air.
No, not as much as I would like to have, but a fair amount. When I was a kid growing up, I was always enthralled with the military, and in particular the Army and the Air Force. I wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize back then that the Army had the flight opportunities that it did, but that was never an expectation on my part. My family did not have a strong military background. Matter of fact, as far as I know, there were only two people. My uncle, who served in the Second World War as a mechanic in the Air Force in the Pacific, he never saw any combat. And then my mother's cousin, who is actually my namesake, he served in the First World War. He had been in the New York National Guard, and they were called up. But other than that, you know, there was no military experience. And yeah, I just didn't think it was something that I was necessarily destined for.
Right, and you were drafted.
Well, yes. Okay. So I was one of seven children.
And that was 66, right? 1966?
That's correct. I was one of seven children, just like Carolyn was, but I was in the middle. And my two older brothers had gone right into college, as, you know, they were expected to. And it worked. One became a math professor and the other an architect. But when I finished high school, I was not ready for college. I knew that, and I think everybody else knew that. So I went and got a job, and in a sense, that was almost volunteering for the draft, but not quite. So I worked for a steamship agency because I liked adventure. I didn't go out on the boats, but I met
all... Where was that?
That was in Houston, Texas.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people don't realize it, but it's, at the time, was the third largest port in the U.S., so we had foreign ships come in and everything. But, you know, I was called to take my physical, and then a few months later, I was drafted. And I went through basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and advanced infantry training. And I was on orders to go to Vietnam as a machine gunner. Mm-hmm. And they had called a group of us out and said, well, your test scores are good enough, we want you to take this test, and if you want, apply for Officer Candidate School, OCS. Okay. So I did that, figuring, well, I'm going to go to Vietnam. I might as well go as a lieutenant if I can make it through. And so I went to Fort Benning, Georgia for Officer Candidate School. And while I was there, I applied for flight school to become a helicopter pilot. And then I was selected. So after Officer Candidate School, I spent a few months as a lieutenant working with troops in a training environment, and then went to flight school. We started at Fort Walters, Texas, and then moved to Fort Rucker, Alabama. And then I went to, to Vietnam in 1969 in January. And I went with what was called an assault helicopter company. Mm-hmm. We had two platoons, which is a grouping of 10 aircraft that would fly 10 aircraft in each platoon that would fly the infantry into the landing zones and then pick them up. And then one platoon of gunships that had the rockets and the machine guns, which would fire to cover the aircraft as they went in. And then after the other aircraft left and the troops were operating, the gunships would stay on station at about 500 feet and provide support to them. One of the policies my unit had, it wasn't general to all of those type units, but mine did, was that if you were going to command the gunship platoon, you would be an infantry officer so that you understood what was going on the ground.
Yeah.
And to reinforce that, you would go out and spend some time with one of the units that we supported. So after I had been in country about 5 months, I went out with a unit of the 25th Infantry Division to spend 2 weeks with them. And while I was out there, we were on a patrol one day, and what today is called an IED, then was called a booby trap or a landmine, went off, and both the company commander and I were wounded. And so I eventually was medevaced to Japan and back to the United States. And when I got out of the hospital, I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and flew for Special Forces. And then I went back on my second tour in Vietnam and flew then.
So you got wounded, and then you went back.
Yes.
Just like that. Yes. I think you covered a lot of the questions I was going to ask you. So what was your life expectancy as an attack helicopter pilot, right? Do I have that right?
Yes. Well, you know, I have never seen a figure that says, well, the life expectancy is such. I mean, yeah. You always hear, oh, the life expectancy of an infantry lieutenant mm-hmm. is, mm-hmm. you know, 3 months, or a Marine infantry lieutenant is 36 seconds in the landing zone, or you know, I've never heard that. But to give you an idea of the way things were, the Huey helicopter, which is the iconic helicopter for right. Vietnam, there were others, but that's what everybody thinks of. The Army had over 7,000 of those, slightly over 7,000 in Vietnam. We lost over 55% of those helicopters. Not all of them were actually shot down, but a lot of them crashed as a result of being in a combat situation, being overloaded, trying to climb out, you know, with the troops on board, not being able to make it through the trees. So, you know, the casualty rate for the aircraft was over 55%. We lost about 2,500 pilots and about 2,500 crew members.
So there's a lot of factors that affect it other than just being shot at.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So what kind of mindset did you have in order to survive your days? Because it's not like, you know, you get up, you get out of bed, and you go to the office. I mean, you knew that this could be the last day. So what was the mindset?
Well, I mean, it could be your last night, too, because you were subject to rockets and mortar mm-hmm. and artillery fire at the bases at night.
Right.
So, I mean, it was equal opportunity. You could die at night or you could die during the day or get wounded.
Right.
You know, quite honestly, and I think this is the vast majority of the people's experience is, you know, when I got there, I mean, I had signed up for this. I knew what I was doing. You know, I might have been drafted, but I had to volunteer to go to officer candidate school and then volunteer to go to flight school. Mm-hmm. And so I knew what I was getting into. So I got there, and then I started flying missions. And long before I was petrified of being shot at, it was the combat operations of flying the helicopters in such close proximity. We had done something similar in flight school, but it was nowhere near as close.
Right.
And when you realize that the blades of the helicopter mm-hmm, are turning mm-hmm. at around 540 miles an hour, if they touch, you're both going down. So, you know, that was kind of an eye-opener, and then doing the landings and such. And, you know, quite honestly, I was petrified. You know, it was something I knew I had to deal with. One of the older pilots, I say older by being in country.
Right. How old were you at this time?
I had just turned 21.
Oh, my gosh.
This guy was actually younger than me. He was 20.
Okay.
The average age of the helicopter was pilot for the Army because they didn't require college. Mm-hmm. At that time, the Air Force required a college degree. The Navy required 2 years of college. The Army had a program called High School to Flight School. Okay. And so the average helicopter pilot for the Army in Vietnam after the initial batch, which was the older guys, was probably 19 and a half, 20 when they got in country. I just turned 21. But going back to the question you asked, so this fella had been in country several months longer than I had and had a lot of experience. And we sat down and, you know, I spilled my guts to him one night. And you know, and we talked, and he explained that he had had the same feelings and everything. And it was just a matter of, you know, actually getting it out and, you know, discussing it with somebody. And it was like it all washed away. And
you're not alone.
Yeah. You're not alone. And also, it's like, you know, all you're doing with all this worry is wasting mental energy and emotional energy. And after that, you didn't worry about it. And I actually credit this fellow with saving my life, because when I got wounded and was laying in a rice paddy waiting for the helicopter to come pick me up, I didn't panic. If I had, I probably would not have made it. So
your training kind of kicked in there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Training, experience, and the camaraderie of, you know, fellow combatants.
So what lifted your morale? When you were deployed, what kind of things lifted your morale?
I don't know that my morale needed lifting. I mean, because I had gotten to the point of, you know, yes, this is something I want to do. So, you know, and again, I had gotten to the point where I had volunteered for this. I had been trained for it, and it was something that that you know, I wanted to do. And it turned out I was pretty good at it.
Yeah.
And consequently, that's why I went back the second time. That's why 2 years went to 26 years.
Right.
So, you know, but that, you know, that doesn't necessarily represent everybody. There are, you know, most people do need a morale booster. And, you know, it's why we serve. And, you know, throughout the years, the military has had programs explaining why we serve. That became a big thing in the Second World War, to explain to the troops why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
That means a lot. It's important. The other thing is you develop the unit cohesion and camaraderie. And one of the lessons that we did learn in Vietnam, because we did not do a good job of that, was that units need to stick together. In Vietnam, the original units went over, but because we didn't go for the duration as they had in the Second World War, or even to a degree in Korea, meaning that when you deployed, you didn't come home till, you know, the war was over or you got shipped back on a stretcher. So it was a one-year tour. So when those original units, you know, they would get replacements for those people that were wounded and, you know, left the unit. But as they started coming up on a year, they didn't have other units to come in and replace them. They started pushing extra replacements in, and then it just became a continuous flow of replacements in and old guys going out. And so what happened was you would get, you know, the new guys came in, were looked at as, oh, the new guys, you know. And they didn't necessarily bond with the older ones. Not saying that the older ones didn't take
them
on.
And by older, what do you mean?
More experience,
okay.
Longer in country. The older ones, you know, might only be 19 years old.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and they could be the sergeants.
Yeah.
So they could, you know, they would, you know, teach you and take you under their wing, but you weren't their friend, necessarily. You didn't have that tight camaraderie. That's not in every case across the board, but that, you know, you lost something that you had with unit cohesion. And,
so you're saying it came more of a revolving door rather than the team?
Absolutely. And even if you were coming back on a second tour, you know, you had some credibility and some bona fides coming in there, but not necessarily in that unit. And you still had to prove yourself in that the unit that you were coming into. After Vietnam, the decision was made, we weren't doing that anymore. It was obvious that a toll had been taken. And over the years, it was worse and worse and worse. And in the last couple years of our involvement in the war, it was really bad.
It's a shame.
Yes, it is.
So what was your return home like from Vietnam?
Nobody ever spit at me, although that has occurred, you know. I was lucky, you know, my family, you know, kind of, they didn't know how to treat me. They treated me with respect and everything, but they didn't
know
how
to. Did you have any issues with transitioning back? Was that hard for you?
No, not. It's interesting, not particularly after the first one, which you would think was when I was wounded.
Yes.
I spent some, you know, a couple months in the hospital and recuperative leave and everything. It was like, okay, I got wounded and, you know, I got better, so everything's good. The second time was more difficult because I had command responsibility, and I made decisions which resulted in, you know, my friends dying, and I've certainly revisited those decisions over the years, and they still stand up as the right decisions. But yeah, there was some adjustment in that. But the other thing that I had was I stayed in the military. So, after my leave, when I returned, I would go to a military base, and I was surrounded by people with the same experiences. And that made it a lot easier in that respect.
Thank goodness for those people.
Yes.
And again, it's that camaraderie.
Right.
You know, it's a club that people like me, just ordinary civilians, just, you know, doesn't understand.
Right. That's like you had Denny on here.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, and you know him. I'd never met him before in my life. We know each other like we've known each other
like
our lives.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Any other highlights you want to share of your service before we flip to Memorial Day? I know there's probably a lot.
No.
It
was great. I enjoyed it.
And I just think your story is so amazing because you got drafted. So you would think once your time was done that you would just want to get out, but you stayed in and now you're a colonel. Yeah. That doesn't happen every day. So, and again, thank you both for your service. So we'll flip to Memorial Day now. And we're always looking for ways to make Memorial Day a little bit more memorable. And it's always kind of hard to figure out, how do you celebrate Memorial Day? Because is it parades and picnics? And, well, of course, people light fireworks off for everything now.
Right.
Is it that, or is it more solemn and more of a remembrance, or is it a combination of the two? So one or the other of you can answer. If you both have thoughts on the question, just go for it. So what does Memorial Day mean to you all?
Carolyn, do you want to go first?
Well, Martin and I were discussing some of the questions on the way down, and that you had provided. I would never served in combat.
Mm-hmm.
So I have not, experienced the loss of a comrade or friend. But I think that Memorial Day itself has, the American people want to have, you know, everything's happy all the time.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be a solemn remembrance of people who have given their lives to in service of our country, and I think that the important thing is that people stop and think about what that means, because a lot of people are not happy with the way things are that in their in their environment, and they think that, you know, they should go maybe live somewhere else because America has all these problems, but
they never go.
It's true. But I think that if we stopped and thought about the fact that we're here and we have the freedoms that we have, that was made possible by those who served and gave their lives. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to say happy Memorial Day is not really appropriate.
Right.
And it's, you know, better to say, let's think about why we have this holiday.
Make it memorable. Mm-hmm. Do something. Yep.
And I think if you grow up in a small town or live in a small town, there's always a parade. I mean, I grew up on a dairy farm, but my mom and dad always, you know, took me and my siblings to, you know, the little town next door.
So you grew up with it, with patriotism.
Yeah, yes, and mm-hmm. we always had our flags, put out flags in the yard. And so I understood what Memorial Day was about.
Yeah.
And even where we live now in Carlisle and a lot of other towns, they have like the Veterans of Foreign War, American Legion, those types of veteran organizations often have a ceremony in town square and with appropriate recognition of those. Yeah, small town America. Yeah. And of course, you know, Washington, D.C. is always has events going to.
So are there any people that come to mind that you honor on Memorial Day or that you think about or that are important to remember for you all on Memorial Day?
Well, certainly the ones that I served with that didn't make it back.
Mm-hmm.
Some were friends, some were just simply, you know, military acquaintances. But, you know, they made the ultimate sacrifice. And it is not only those individuals that I think about, but I think about their families, their parents, you know, their siblings, their spouse, their children.
There's a sacrifice there.
And that's a never-ending sacrifice for those people. And, you know, that's why I am so involved with the Liberty Warbirds, mm-hmm. because we meet many of those people, and we can make a difference to the survivors. I've got some very interesting stories, you know, in relation to that. But, you know, it can make a difference, even 55 years later.
Sure.
Going back to your question about should it be solemn, should it be celebratory, in my mind, it should be both. You know, the ideal situation would be that, you know, the family get up in the morning, you know, as a family, you know, have breakfast, whatever, go to a local cemetery, whether they know anybody there or not, but walk around, at least in, as Carolyn says, in the small towns, you know, we go out, we decorate with the flags mm-hmm. and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Walk around, look at those flags, you know, read some of the tombstones and everything. Be somber, understand what that's about. And then go have a good time and celebrate America and its values, even if we are not living them to the fullest every day of every year. We have the opportunity to, make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so be somber, you know, for a part of the day and celebrate the rest of the day.
A combination of two. And just because we have the fallen here that we're honoring, even though they passed,
right,
their patriotism didn't. So it's up to us to carry that on.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I can tell, Martin, when you talk about that, that it still affects you when you remember those who were under your command, you know, who you had to make the tough decisions,
right,
you know, and they might not have come back. How do you handle that grief? How do you get beyond that?
Well, you never get beyond it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. 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 Again, the team, the fellow brothers. Yeah. So, okay. So is there a specific Memorial Day that stands out for you? Any specific Memorial Day that stands out for you?
No, not for me.
For you.
Not that I can think of.
No. And I had a veteran one time tell me that every day is Memorial Day for him.
Well,
because he remembers his, and I'm sure you can relate to that. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Memorial Day for me has changed over the years because when I was born in 66. So I came at the end of the Vietnam War, and there was pretty much a time of peace all through the time that I grew up.
Right.
until we started getting back into these into wars again. And then it changed to where, from my perspective, I see people being more patriotic, whereas before it was just the picnic. We went to grandma's house, you know. And so I saw a change there. Have you all seen a change with respect to Memorial Day past to the present?
I think for it depends on where we were stationed, I guess you could say, because different places celebrate differently, or not celebrate, but have different types of remembrances. So that's, I would say, why one doesn't really stand out over the other. But I think that the, like you mentioned, there was a time when it was just another holiday,
picnic,
but yeah. But I think that there is a recognition and a more honoring of the of the holiday's true meaning that's come about.
Yes, and let's hope that continues.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, what duties or obligations does our society have toward those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice?
I would say that they truly have an obligation to understand the founding principles of America, the concepts upon which it was based, maybe not always exercised, you know, to the best, but always having the opportunity to achieve that that desired goal that our founding fathers and mothers, even though they weren't mentioned in history, had for this nation. And when I say understand it, I'm talking about actually doing a little study on their own, you know, reading the Constitution once a year. It only takes 30 minutes to do that. reading the Federalist Papers that explains why the Constitution was adopted and what the meaning of it is. Not just reading something on you know, social media or in a newspaper, but actually studying it. I don't think we teach that enough in our, you know, primary and secondary education, and it's probably totally optional at the college level these days. So I think we have an obligation. And if you go look at those flags in the cemeteries, you know, and understand that those people died in order for these concepts to live on. That's the obligation, mm-hmm. from my perspective.
I love the idea of reading the Constitution or just researching something about our, even researching our founding fathers on Memorial Day, like make that your time to do it.
Right.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Thank you for that. Let's see. How do people show their gratitude? Well, I guess that could be the same thing. Any other points you can add about like civilians like me showing their gratitude on Memorial Day for the fallen? Other than
I think maybe, you know, if you're at a parade or you're at a cemetery, if it's possible to, you know, if you see someone else that seems to be there honoring a family member, a friend, just to maybe say something that, you know, about what the holiday means to them, and mm-hmm. and thank you for their support,
right,
and
right,
sacrifice.
So is there anything that you want people to understand about Memorial Day?
You know, the the basic idea of, you know, truly understand that Memorial Day is to honor those who have lost their lives in service to their country. You know, it's not Veterans Day.
Yes.
Veterans Day comes in.
I knew where he was going with that.
And oh, by the way, for those that are actually serving, you know, we have Armed Forces Day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people get that confused, and it bothers me, you know, mostly about about Memorial Day.
Yes. Yeah, because that's a heavy holiday.
Yes.
That's a heavy holiday where we should take time, you know, to recognize the fallen and the sacrifice that's made.
Right.
So why do you two love America so much?
because it has given us, I speak for myself, but also probably for Carolyn, and she will speak, but it has given us the opportunity to be what we wanted to be, and it has established in us the desire to not just the desire, but the with the understanding of what real freedom is, and freedom's not free.
Absolutely.
It comes with a price, but that price is worth paying. And, you know, it is truly a land of opportunity. Both of us started out as privates.
Yep.
And we did fairly well in the military. And, you know, we were just given the opportunity, and then it was up to us.
So who pulls rank at home? Like, who's the boss? Your fifth colonel?
There is none.
And it's funny that you said that. Yes, because in the article that I read about you all, you work together. You're a team.
Yes. Yeah. Martin's always been the big picture guy, and I'm the detail person.
Okay.
He cooks, I clean up.
Oh, so it works. Everybody knows their lanes, right? Yes. Just like in the military.
And sometimes we have to, you know, be cognizant of whose lane we're in.
And sometimes we have to have a staff meeting, too.
That's funny. So as we wrap up here, I know you all are a part of the Liberty Warbirds. Mm-hmm. So do you want to speak about that organization all and what it does and what it's all about? We had Denny in here. He did a little bit. He talked a little bit about it.
Before we go to that, may I all mention I have my shirt on today.
Yes, absolutely.
So they changed the name. Military Women's Memorial is in Washington, D.C., and it is in a building that is right next to Arlington Cemetery. It's like in a horseshoe shape. Most people don't know it's there or don't have any idea what it represents, but is the only memorial to women of all services. Like the Army has an Army Women's Memorial, museum, and different other services have their specific ones, but this is for all services, and the goal is to register the service of every woman who's ever served, whether she's alive now or has already passed on. And they do they have displays, they have celebrations and honor ceremonies, and since it's right next to Arlington, a lot of times after there's a funeral or some other type of ceremony, they'll congregate at the Women's Memorial. It's open to the public, and I would urge that every time you meet a woman who's been in the military, or even ask if they've registered, and even if they have not been in the service, maybe they have, and the guys too, they have a family member or know of someone who has served, and it's free to register.
Is it online?
Yes, it's online. I have the brochure here, but
so it's the Military Women's Memorial.
Yes, if you Google that, it'll come up, and you can register online, and like I said, it's free, and it's a wonderful organization.
Thank you for sharing that.
And I would like to second my support for that, because during my tenure in the Army, you know, we went from, as Carolyn said, all of the women in the Army were in the Women's Army Corps, and they would be tasked out to support, like, administrative things and such. And during my tenure, you know, they achieved more and more opportunities. And when I was an infantry brigade headquarters commandant with the 7th Infantry Division, I got the first few women that were assigned to the staff to support that. I got some of the earliest female aviators in my units. And I was retired before they were able to get into the Rangers and the infantry. But tremendous progress was made to give them the same opportunities. And just like throughout most of American history and history throughout the world, you know, women's contributions are significantly underrepresented, and they have been in the military. And so the Women's Military Memorial is one effort to try and correct that. And I fully support that.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, so to Liberty Warbirds now, which you're both a part of?
Yes.
Okay.
So
started, he started with the group.
Yeah. And then being a team, Carolyn got sucked in. but Liberty Warbirds Association is a small nonprofit that operates here in central Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It operates out of the Lancaster Airport, which is actually in Lititz.
Right.
It was started by one Vietnam veteran and one, at the time, young man that had always been in love with our helicopter pilots, but didn't qualify for Army flight school, so he became a submariner, but we don't hold that against him, and also known as a bubblehead. And and then he, you know, after he got out of service and was established professionally, he, you know, he took flying lessons and learned to become a helicopter pilot, met this Vietnam veteran helicopter pilot, and they decided that they should start an organization and to honor the Vietnam veterans, and because the Huey helicopter is just the iconic symbol of the Vietnam War, after a lot of research and fundraising, they bought a, you know, a surplus UH-1, brought it back to central Pennsylvania in 2015, and totally rebuilt it, brought it back to flying status. Denny, who you have on earlier, was a critical part of that. In addition to the hundreds of thousands of dollars that they raised to put into it, there were 15,000 man hours of work that went into it. It has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb by the FAA, who has said that it is one of the best UH-1 helicopters they've seen. We fly it to various events, primarily to honor the veterans. Our motto is honor, educate, and restore. To honor the veterans, all veterans of the Vietnam War in particular, but all veterans, to educate the public on not only the role of the UH-1 in Vietnam, but what America's involvement in Vietnam, you know, was constituted of in terms of how we got into it, why we stayed there, and what we did there. And then restore originally was to restore the helicopter. But we've expanded that now to include the concept of restoring the honor and dignity of the veterans of Vietnam that they didn't necessarily get when they came home. And unfortunately, it's very expensive to fly that helicopter. It costs us $2,500 per hour to fly it. So if somebody up in upper central Pennsylvania that's a flight hour away wants us to bring it up there and then bring it back, that's $5,000. We don't yet have corporate sponsorship, although, you know, we are looking for that. So it's basically we operate on donations, and normally if an organization, say the American Legion or somebody else, wants us to come there, you know, we work with them, and but they basically have to fund us to come there. We would love to have enough funds to be able to go out and, you know, offset all or at least some of those costs. Right. But we're not at that position yet. But we intend to grow.
Do you fly it?
Yes.
That's a hard yes.
Yes.
Now, what's that feel like to get back in there?
I truly cannot describe it. It is a wondrous thing. You know, I continued to fly the UH-1 after Vietnam. My last flight in a military UH-1 was in 1992. I've flown a civilian version of it since then, nowhere near as often enough as I'd like. And so to get back into that is just absolutely thrilling. And as a matter of fact, we do maintenance during the winter. And it's just come out of our winter maintenance program. We've done the test flights on it. And tomorrow, as a matter of fact, four of us are going out with our senior pilot and doing some refresher training.
Oh, and, people can come visit.
Yes.
Oh. People can come visit for that?
Well, not for the flight training, but
the hangar.
Yes.
Well, yes, they can come out to the hangar, and you know, we are open virtually every Saturday. Now, you'll have to go to our website, which is currently
it's on Facebook.
Yes.
Is it Facebook or a website?
Both.
Oh, okay.
The website currently just has some information, but it doesn't have the schedule.
Okay.
That will change within the week, and our schedule will be posted for the events that we will be going to throughout the year, throughout central Pennsylvania and northern Virginia. Facebook will have an update during the week as to, you know, whether the aircraft will be at the hangar or at another location that we're flying to. People are always welcome. If there is a group of veterans or veterans' families that want to make a personal visit, we can accommodate that. They can get to us through contact on the website. You know, we would love to have you come over.
Oh, I would love to come up. And I'm sure community media will put all that information up on this segment as well, so you'll have it out there for that.
Yes.
Well, you two are just amazing. Thank you again for your service. It was such an honor and pleasure. And I know, Martin, some of the questions were hard for you to ask or to answer some of my questions. So I do appreciate your courage in doing that. I know Memorial Day has to be hard for you at times. So, and I always tell veterans to tell their stories no matter how hard they are. Family members need to hear the stories. They need to hear what their family members went through, because they won't understand the sacrifice, you know, if they don't hear the stories. And there would have been no Roots for Boots had there been no stories. So even if you have to write it down, just tell your stories. So with that, we're going to wrap up another edition of Open House. I'm Christy Lucas, your guest host today, signing off.